This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I am Chinedu Ofor, and here's what's coming up.
This unprecedented expulsion should be a matter of deep concern for us all, as it relates to the core of relations between the UN and member states.
That was UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres on Ethiopia's expulsion of seven UN staff, alleging they were meddling in the country's internal affairs. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. With the UN focusing yesterday on the worsening crisis in Ethiopia, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres hit back at the expulsion of seven UN staff, demanding proof of accusations that they were meddling in internal affairs, as the Ethiopian government claims. He urged joint efforts to halt the violence and carve a path to peace before a bad situation gets worse.
The country is facing an immense humanitarian crisis that demands immediate attention. All efforts should be squarely focused on saving lives and avoiding a massive human tragedy. This makes last Thursday's announcement by the government of Ethiopia to expel seven senior UN officials, most of them humanitarian staff, particularly disturbing. This unprecedented expulsion should be a matter of deep concern for us all, as it relates to the core of relations between the UN and member states.
Guterres pointed out that UN officials and aid agencies claim the Ethiopian government is blocking efforts to get aid to the needy.
I urge the government to allow the unrestricted movement of desperately needed fuel, cash, communications equipment, and humanitarian supplies into all the regions in need. And I appeal to all members of Security Council to do all they can to support these calls and to unify behind the efforts of the United Nations and its partners in Ethiopia.
Ethiopia's UN ambassador, Taye Atkeselassie Amdi, accused the UN staff of making up data, falsely claiming hunger was used as a weapon of war and that people had died from hunger, and of supporting government's foe, the Tigray People's Liberation Front.
Expulsion was not our primary course of action. In multiple occasions, we explained our concern to UN officials. On July 8, 2021, the Deputy Prime Minister and Foreign Minister of Ethiopia wrote a letter to the UN Secretariat explaining in great details the misconducts of the UN staff that require corrective measures. We also summoned some individuals and warned them to halt their misconduct. Nevertheless, the transgression continued unabated.
Linda Thomas-Greenfield, the UN ambassador to the UN, said the Ethiopian government's actions, including accounts of rape and hunger being used as weapons of war, violence against civilians, the UN staff being expelled, follow, quote, a pattern of escalating obstruction, unquote, that is calculated to intimidate and silence, unquote. She added that the hunger situation is similar to those at the start of the famine in Somalia in 2011. Tanzanian writer Abdulrazak Gonay has been awarded a Nobel Prize for Literature. The Swedish Academy said today the award was in recognition of his, quote, uncompromising and compassionate penetration of the effects of colonialism, unquote. Born in Zanzibar in 1948 and based in England, Gonay is a professor at the University of Kent. He's the author of 11 novels, including, quote, Paradise, unquote, which was shortlisted for the Booker Prize in 1994. The prestigious award comes with a gold medal and 10 million Swedish krona, that's over $1.14 million. The World Health Organization is recommending that children in sub-Saharan Africa and other regions of the continent with moderate to high malaria transmission receive a malaria vaccine. The WHO says malaria is the top killer of children in sub-Saharan Africa, causing the deaths of more than 260,000 under age 5 every year. The vaccine, known as Mosquirix, proved effective in a pilot program in Ghana, Kenya, and Malawi that has reached more than 800,000 children since 2019. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus praised the new vaccine during Wednesday's announcement, calling the achievement, quote, a long-held-out but unattainable dream, unquote.
We still have a very long road to travel, but this is a long stride down that road. This vaccine is a gift to the world, but its value will be felt most in Africa because that's where the burden of malaria is greatest.
The UN Health Agency says a large-scale pilot program shows that more than two-thirds of children who are not sleeping on their necks are benefiting from the vaccine, which requires four doses. The program also found a 30% reduction in deadly severe malaria, even in areas where insecticide-treated nets are widely used and there's a good access to diagnosis and treatment. The vaccine has been under development for 30 years by global pharmaceutical giant GlaxoSmithKline, with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation providing late-stage development funding. Libya's House of Representatives has amended the date of the legislative elections. The presidential election will take place as scheduled on December 24th, with the legislative elections following a month later. The U.S. is stepping up its support for elections in Libya as rivals are still divided over the electoral law. Last week, the top commander of American forces in Africa visited Tripoli to meet with representatives of the country's two rival governments, capping a flurry of recent calls by U.S. officials to abide by the 24 December voting timeline. Jason Pack, president of Libya's analysis and author of, quote, Libya and the Global Disorder, unquote, discussed these developments with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
Ever since this date of December 24th, 2021 was announced at the ceasefire agreement coordinated by the UN on October 23rd, 2020, there's been a debate. What does it exactly mean to have elections? What are we voting for? Who has the right to set the terms and conditions? The Libyan Political Dialogue Forum set up by the UN didn't fulfill its function to kind of correctly push forward these elections and has been in a way moribund due to UN Special Envoy Jan Kubisch's lack of progress and kind of lack of grasp of the file. Therefore, the HOR has stepped into this void and has postulated, oh, we want the elections to happen, we want the elections to happen, while in a way mostly blocking and delaying them. Now it's finally passed this legislation that you referenced. It hasn't exactly amended the date because they've stuck to the date that the UN proposed, but they've bifurcated the legislative and the presidential elections in a way to let the presidential elections happen, but then prevent the legislative elections from never happening. Maybe neither of them will happen because the higher state council was not consulted, and they have the ability to stir up some legal challenges.
The U.S. is stepping up its support for elections in Libya as rivals are still divided about the electoral law. Last week, the top commander of the American forces in Africa visited Tripoli for meetings with representatives of the country's two rival governments, capping a flurry of recent calls by U.S. officials to abide by the 24th of December voting timeline. How could that help the troubled election process?
The Tripoli visit by the AFRICOM commander, as well as Ambassador Norland, was meant as a symbolic gesture to try to keep the sides on board for the elections. And yes, symbolically, the Americans have been doing quite a lot in the last few months, and that has been meant to threaten spoilers. If you get out of line, look, we're just showing you we have some military might and we have the ability to use sanctions. However, we haven't seen the Americans deploy that military might or use any new sanctions. So I don't know if it really helps the troubled election process. It's just a symbolic gesture pointing against our enemies like Russia, who may wish to meddle in Libya and prevent the election.
In Congress, the House of Representatives passed several measures that take explicit aim at Eastern strongman Khalifa Haftar and his self-proclaimed Libyan National Army, while also authorizing up to $30 million to help Libya with its election. What is concerning the U.S. Congress about General Haftar?
Well, you're right in pointing out that the Libya Stabilization Act of 2019 has now passed the House of Representatives of the U.S. It isn't law yet, though, because the Senate hasn't passed it. That bill was meant initially to provide a counterbalance to Trump policy and gestures, which seemed to favor Haftar, by signaling out Haftar and the LNA for potential sanctions. It doesn't actually impose any sanctions, and it doesn't really hit his backers in any way, although the UAE has been added to the list of those who could be sanctioned. In short, the bill doesn't really do much of anything. It is, again, another symbolic gesture that could allow the Biden administration to do something, although the executive has the power to do those sanctions on their own through the Treasury Department and OFAC anyway. What concerns the U.S. Congress about Haftar is his being supported by Russia and the UAE and the kind of larger great power game with Russia and the UAE in the region. However, it's crucial to point out that anything that the House of Representatives has done is merely symbolic gestures, and it's the executive branch which runs foreign policy in the United States.
That was Jason Pack, president of Libya Analysis and author of, quote, Libya and the Global Disorder, unquote, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. Mali's army says gunmen ambushed army troops yesterday in the West African country's central region, killing at least 9 soldiers and wounding 11 others. The army said 3 army vehicles were destroyed after hitting explosive devices in the Mopti region between Koro and Bandiagara. The French news agency AFP reports that local officials say 16 soldiers died in the attack. AFP also said the army claimed to have pursued the attackers and killed 15 of them. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack, but it is similar to those carried out by extremist groups linked to Al-Qaeda that are active in central Mali. Mali has been battling to contain an Islamic extremist insurgency since 2012. School is back in session in the Democratic Republic of Congo, but not for some children. Teachers at many government schools refused to go back to work this week when the new term began Monday. Reporter Jaffa Al-Katanti in Goma tells VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson the problem has to do with the pay cut many teachers faced after the government took over paying their salaries.
Here, the government launched the free school program, but the government just paid $120 per month for all teachers. What is not enough money? Because before, some teachers in some schools were paid $500 a month. So teacher cannot understand why they have to teach and receive few money, and the government say we are paying and parents will not pay again. That's the problem. So the teachers ask more money from government and the insurance to get a good life, because everything is expensive in DRC. They pay for everything. They pay for health. They pay for electricity, and they just receive $120. They decide to do not open school till the government will give them the same amount they got when parents was paying.
Now, obviously, though, parents like the idea of a free education for their children. Are there parents who are saying, well, no, we'll go ahead and pay the teachers, or are they pushing the government also to pay the teachers better?
The problem is first the situation of the country. A lot of parents are jobless. So for them, the decision of the government is the best decision possible. They cannot pay again. But some parents who have some money, parents who have jobs or business or workers, decide to leave their children from the official, the government schools to the private schools and pay for a good education. Because that influences also the education of children in school. A teacher who was being paying, who was being paid $500, and someone who is paid $120 will not teach in the same situation. Teachers said they will continue to boycott till the government will respond to their revendication. We don't know when the government will respond.
That was journalist Jaffa Al-Katanti in Goma speaking by phone with my colleague, Kate Pound-Dawson. Archbishop Emeritus Desmond Tutu, one of South Africa's 4 Nobel Peace Prize laureates, is celebrating his 90th birthday today. Tutu earned international recognition for his immense contribution in ending the country's oppressive apartheid system. Many say the name, quote, Rainbow Nation, unquote, which he coined, has been the glue that has kept South Africans together this far. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday.
These are birthday wishes from those who gathered at the St. George's Cathedral in Cape Town to celebrate Tutu's life. He became a bishop after his dream of becoming a medical doctor was frustrated by lack of funds. He was promoted to be the Anglican Dean in Johannesburg, becoming the first black person to occupy the position. This role positioned him in direct confrontation with the apartheid system that severely oppressed the country's black majority. It is this strong stance that landed him a Nobel Peace Prize in 1984. In 1994, South Africa's first black president, Nelson Mandela, appointed him to chair the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, tasked with addressing injustices of the past and fostering harmony between the former oppressors, the minority whites, and their largely black victims. South Africans know him for his jovial mood and unique laughter. Here, he was delivering a speech at the University of California in 2008.
We were in Greensboro in North Carolina, and the waiter comes and he says, "Are you a singer or something?" Which I thought was very good for the soul.
But he did not tolerate injustices even from the black government. This is what he said in 2014 when the South African government denied a visa to the Dalai Lama, the Tibetan's spiritual leader.
"This government, our government, is worse than the apartheid government. Our government says it will not support Tibetans who are being oppressed viciously by the Chinese."
Advocate Dumisa Ntsebeza, who later worked as a commissioner in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, told reporters he clearly remembers how Tutu intervened when, as a student, he got into trouble for challenging apartheid authorities.
"Desmond Tutu, on hearing of the fines that we are supposed to be paying, raised money for us and we were freed from jail. When we were expelled from Fortes, as a result of that, he organized money. Those are the funds that assisted me in completing my degree."
And Alan Busak, a church cleric who fought against apartheid alongside Tutu, told those at the birthday celebration that Tutu was their hope and inspiration.
"Desmond Tutu was almost the personification of that spirituality of struggle. And I remember so many times we would come together to talk strategy. How would we do this? How would we do that? How would that march be planned? But before every single meeting and after every single meeting, we would first say, let us just pray."
Tutu now spends more time at home with his wife, Nomalizo Leah, who he married in 1955. 2 decades ago, he was diagnosed with prostate cancer, which has caused him to frequent the hospital in recent years. U.S. President Joe Biden was among those sending birthday wishes, saying he was inspired by Tutu's commitment to championing human rights and to always speaking out for what is right. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Humanitarian agencies and Somali officials say they deeply regret the arrest and forced displacement of thousands of people who have been expelled from the town of Lasanod in the self-declared Republic of Somaliland. The forced displacement has been taking place since Saturday as police in Somaliland, citing security concerns, routed up the people from their businesses, homes and streets, officials and witnesses said. Many health workers from Zimbabwe migrate to South Africa in search of employment and improved pay, but their hope for a better life in their southern African neighbor may be at risk. There are indications the South African's Public Health Directorate is turning away applicants from Zimbabwe. Andy Gondo has more on the story.
South African authorities have apparently begun to reject applications by health workers from Zimbabwe on grounds that its neighbor is currently facing a staffing crisis due to migration. The letter is in VOA's possession and signed by Sindile Sotlala, the Departmental Director of Workplace Management, to some of the rejected applicants. It explains that the government of South Africa is obliged to adhere to all the relevant protocols between member states of the Southern African Development Community, the African Union, as well as the World Health Organization as it pertains to the recruitment of health professionals from developing countries. The latter adds that the agreements and protocols include a provision that prevents the uncontrolled recruitment of health professionals from countries with public health systems facing huge staff shortages. Observers affirm that Zimbabwe is faced with massive staff migration of healthcare professionals due to poor working conditions and long-standing pay disputes with the government. Nurses currently net $23,226 or US$226 on the official exchange of around 87 to the dollar. But economic analysts and observers say that in reality, nurses earn US$136 using the parallel market rate of around 170 Zim dollars to the US dollar. Enoch Dongo of the Zimbabwe Nurses Association, ZNA, concurs that the authorities are ignoring the plight of nurses, leaving them with no option but to leave the country.
There is a quite number of nurses that are moving from Zimbabwe to other countries. The figures has been doubled compared to last year. The nurses' salaries are the one of the lowest paid in Southern Africa and as well as in the world as a whole. And now with the coming in of COVID and the demand of nurses around the world, we have seen countries like USA, UK, Ireland, Australia, and other countries recruiting more and more experienced nurses. And this has left a huge gap in our public hospitals where...
Dongo says while the situation is poised to be dire with the loss of highly experienced staff to other countries, nurses are not complaining.
We are much worried about that. But for the nurses, it's a welcome development and a good move for them, for their welfare and their families, since they are moving from Zimbabwe to other countries where they are being recognized, where they are being given salaries which can take care of themselves and their families. Hence, we are urging our government to relook at the remunerations of nurses, to relook at the working in conditions and the environment where the nurses are working, and improve on those. It's going to be a crisis soon because we have seen even tutors, those who are training nurses, they are leaving the country, and other senior nurses whom we used to know that these are the people that are really there to give guidance to the juniors. But because of the economical hardships that they are facing, they are leaving the
Still, the migration southward seems to be facing challenges. VOA reached out to the Zimbabwe South Africa Association, which works with other bodies such as the Zimbabwe Migrant Workers Association in South Africa, for their take on the development with the South African authorities. Mabuto Mabena is a leader of the organization and chairperson of the Zimbabwe community in South Africa.
The letter that is said to be coming from the South African Minister of Health is as a result of a SADC protocol, which was entered into by SADC member states. So our understanding is that South Africa is implementing that protocol. But we also know that South Africa recognizes the reality that you have a migration within the region, and that migration is a global phenomenon. It has then sought to manage migration.
According to Mabena, South Africa reviewed its policy on international migration in 2015 and in 2017 published a white paper on international migration. He says he hopes that the proposals on migration contained in the report that are before the South African Parliament will be adopted by the legislative body. Others say the white paper only referred to unskilled labor and not to professionals such as healthcare workers. But analysts say that given the economic shrinkage, heavy job losses in South Africa's own economy and impending elections, it may not be politically prudent for the ruling ANC to be implementing measures seen as taking away jobs from locals. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I am Chinedu from Washington. For all latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. And thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.